Because what's next? You know, now we're going to destigmatize putting people in cinder block shoes and throwing them off bridges, you know, or whatever. It's like that's the next step. It's like Goodfellas was sourced to be a cautionary tale, not a instructional video.
Welcome to the Stand Firm Podcast. We're recording this episode on Tuesday, February 3rd, 2026. I'm Nick Lannon of Grace Anglican Church in Louisville, Kentucky, and I'm here with Matt Kennedy of the Anglican Church of the Good Shepherd in Binghamton, New York, and J.D. Koch of Holy Trinity Parish in Hillsdale, Michigan. Guys, how you doing today?
Great. How are you?
Great, Nick. Thanks.
Well, I have a plumber in my house. It's kind of like being held hostage. He could call and I could be torn away from the podcast at any moment. What's the last large home improvement thing you had to have done? Or you do your own stuff, right, Matt?
Well, to the extent that I can, I'm really bad at it, but I'm also cheap, so I'm happy to do a bad job by kind of avoid spending any
money. A winning combination, bad and cheap.
That's right. That's a tagline right there. That's right. I may not be, I'm pretty cheap, but I'm also terrible. We just ran out of propane. I've never had a house fueled by a gigantic propane tank, and there needs to be some sort of warning, you know, like in your car, like propane low, because we just woke up Sunday morning and had no hot water. So I had the last hot shower and I just came out to Lies and was like, I've got bad news and bad news. You know, it looks like our heat is out and there's no hot water. So, but we got that fixed. So
how quickly can one order a refill of a giant propane tank?
It's pretty cool. I guess it's fairly common because they came, we called them yesterday morning. They came in the afternoon. Nice. And giant truck just filled it, topped her up. But they should have like the water should turn purple or something.
Yeah,
before,
for sure. Like something, some kind of warning.
Like, you've got 10 minutes.
They must
more.
Have an app for that. Like that app you have where you put the sensor in your turkey. They must have a sensor you can put in the propane tank that'll communicate to your phone. That'll tell you when it's
low. Yeah, it should. Maybe you get on that. Our listener, if he's a web developer or an app developer, I'll do real time.
Call us.
That's right. I'll put product testing right here in the frigid Northeast, wherever I am, Midwest.
Midwest,
I'm in the hand. Now I can talk anyone from Michigan.
Right.
I can tell you exactly where on the hand I am.
In the middle.
I'm in the wrong.
Right.
I'm in the wrong place. I'm on the one that people drive through. But there you go.
Well, this week we thought we'd talk about an article in the online version of the Wall Street Journal by our old friend Aaron Wren called "America is Awash in Vice," about the legalization and proliferation of gambling, drugs, and pornography. JD, when you sent us this article, you said we should talk about how we ended up living in Biff World, a reference to the dystopic future ruled by Biff Tannen in Back to the Future 2.
I figured
that was a reference
collection.
Someone else had come up with. It was too perfect. But a quick online search suggests that it seems original to you. You might want to copyright that.
I don't know. It feels like the authors of Back to the Future 2 were like sent literally back from the future to instead of Biff, it's Trump. So there you have it.
So guys, how do we get to where we are? How do we shepherd people who live in Biff World? And is there a way back to the proverbial 1985 of Marty McFly?
Do we need to explain to Matt what Back to the Future is? You've seen that, right, Matt? I mean,
you should do it for yourself. You go first.
Wren's argument is that as Christianity has declined, vice has increased. Is that as simple as it is?
Well, I think that's certainly a large component of it. I have some other thoughts about some of the actual intent behind it, but at the base level, of course, and he lists some of the great kind of moral movements that were spearheaded by Christians in the West. You think of, you know, but at least in the last couple of centuries, with abolition, to temperance, to clubs devoted to moral improvement. In particular, usually it's feral men. You know, Al Mohler talks about this a lot. Like in God's design, there's a power to men that when gone undirected, like a loose cannon, can really be very destructive. And so a lot of these movements have centered on domesticating in a positive way, or at least harnessing men's positive energy and not having it negatively expended. And so, as the Christian prohibitions against gambling and pornography and vice, as he says, have waned, and the frankly the fear of judgment and eternal damnation has at least subsided, and even in the pulpits of quote unquote churches across the country, it's unsurprising that you have people who have been given over, as Romans 1 would say, to their own wants and desires, and there's a lot of money to be made. There's always been a lot of money to be made in the excesses of the flesh, and we're watching our government, in particular, cannibalize its own people for the quote children, supposedly going to education. And I was just shocked by this the other day. I think I actually put it up on X, and when I reposted Aaron's article, that I took a picture of it. But I was so dismayed that at the local store where you drop the UPS packages off here, they now have a big advertisement that the Michigan lottery can be purchased with credit cards. So you have like
Jeez.
vice upon vice upon vice, and it's all been supported and encouraged by the government. And so we started a revolution because we were upset about having taxes on our tea, and now we are the product that is being bled dry from the inside out through our own government. Well, that's infuriating, to put it mildly, but there we are.
Like the perfect storm too, with as the church receded, technology increased, and so you have ready access to things that would have taken a lot more work to have access to in the past. Not only the fact that online gambling is all over the place, but pornography and the ways that you can sin
That's right.
has been exponentially increased, multiplied, and so if you don't have an internal check, if you don't have any kind of internal discipline of yourself, then it's almost impossible to avoid these things. So, and I don't know, I'm not even speaking about, to get the internal check, you have to have people around you. Let's say, set aside the Christian aspect of it. You have to have people around you who teach you self-discipline. Like you, as a child, you don't have it. As a teenager, you need to learn it. And traditionally, whether Christian or not, parents try to instill self-discipline and self-control, but how do you do that with like a 16-year-old boy who can easily get pornography without even making much of an effort, easily get a hold of online? I read the stat in Aaron's Rin's article. Over 50% or 50% of men between the ages of 18 and 42, is it, have online gambling accounts? That's
Well,
insane.
they monetize sports, and then they push sports gambling. And so now your fantasy football team becomes, side hustle for another way to make, an easy buck, which of course,
Lose an
what is it?
easy buck.
Proverbs. Lose an easy buck. As Proverbs says, the quest for ill-gotten gains, you set a snare for your own soul. I love that. And people either deny that they have a soul or are naive to the detrimental effects. And it's heartbreaking. I mean, I counsel, now I have a lot of a lot well a wide range of ages in this church. A lot of college guys, a lot of younger men than I am. And the prevalence of all of these vices is a real cancer. It's a real, it's really destructive. And there's a lot of, by God's grace, defenses that people have put in place to protect them. But it's a necessary protection. I mean, it's like a constant barrage. I mean, you can get rid of your phone, and you can still, you still go to the drop your UPS package off, and five extra bucks, you can make $100,000 if you just scratch off here. And oh, by the way, you're helping the kids, and it's just a game. And you start there, and then one, you win. God forbid you actually start winning, and then you're hooked, and it's heartbreaking. And it's like when I was railing against, we had a strip club. There still is a strip club in Hilton Head, family friendly Hilton Head Island, and I just kept telling our congregation, like, one of you needs to run for mayor on the platform of get rid of this strip club. And it wasn't from a position of like, holier than thou exactly. But I was like, I actually had heard accounts of people who, the way that things happened, stumbled into a place they never expected to, because it happened to be 150 feet from a hotel or something. and really destabilize their life, we should say. Or young men, just want to have a fun night out in the town instead of having to drive to, an hour and a half away. Just go, and even then they shouldn't be able to. But it was like the proximity and the ease, as you said, Matt, is really one of the most pernicious aspects of this whole thing, because vice has always existed. There's always been brothels, have always been games of chance. There's always been, somebody that's willing to sell you some drugs somewhere. But now it's, I mean, even drugs, now you can, I was downtown Charleston last weekend and I think I got a contact high, maybe the whole time. I can't really remember. I was very giddy. I'm just kidding. But it really was unbelievable. I was like, and I used to be naive enough to be like, it literally smelled like a skunk. And now I'm like, oh, well,
Yeah.
Lord have mercy.
One of the other things that's new, I think, and this is to piggyback off something that you said, Matt, about self-control. I wonder if the urge to self-control and to teach your children to control themselves is actually waning too, because I imagine that, like many of the other cultural mores we have that are currently being resisted, it would be easy to say that thing that you think you need to control yourself against, that urge is actually just passed down to you by, your white Western patriarchal colonizers. It's really not good for you to control yourself. You should feed whatever yourself wants. It's yourself that is the real you.
No, I think you're right about that. I think if you talk to a lot of people who are not Christian, who are just kind of lapping up the secular ideology out there, yeah, pornography is a great way to either express yourself. If you're a young woman, you have an OnlyFans thing, express your sexuality, or it's the natural release of your sexual needs. And so remember during the campaign, the Biden campaign, I'm not sure if the Biden campaign paid for it, but someone who was in support of Biden put out those pro-porn commercials
Trump's
for
going to
young.
arrest you for watching porn. Yeah, it's a
Yeah.
fact.
You're there. You are just trying to watch your pornography, and then Trump shows up in your living room or something, and that's and it was so. There's, I think, so all of this, like the ease with which you can take hold of it because of technology, the lack of a sense that it needs to be controlled because, hey, that's who you are. You're just expressing yourself, whatever that might be. You got to be able to, you got to be able to do these things. But then also the lack of shame. When I was growing up, there was a sense of shame. If you were caught, if I would have been mortified if my parents would have caught me looking at a dirty magazine. I would have been like super, super embarrassed. And my dad's not a Christian, or he is now, but he wasn't then. And I didn't.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe it was different social groups, but. I wasn't a Christian, but even so, my friends didn't pass those magazines around. We were like super embarrassed by the whole thing. And gambling is just something that I don't understand how I think you're right about how it became so prevalent, but seeing someone waste all their money in a casino is also something like was kind of considered a down and out kind of thing to do. Maybe you'd go to Vegas once a year or something, but losing your money consistently or engaging consistently in that kind of thing. It just was, you didn't want to tell anyone about it. You didn't want to know anyone to know that you were doing that if you were doing that. And when someone was found to be doing that, you thought, oh man, what happened to him? Why is he in that
Well, that's
situation?
the issue, right? Now you don't ever have to be found out unless you actually go to like prison because you can do it from the safety of your phone. You don't have to drive to Vegas anymore.
Well, it's 50% of the people, 50% of men doing it. I mean, I'm sure, and I'm sure. The odds, I'm sure the stats for pornography must be higher. I think the last time I saw it was 70 to 80% of young men are regularly watching porn. 60%, if I'm getting my numbers right, I might have them wrong, but 60% within the church of young men regularly, maybe not daily, but on a regular basis with pornography. Outside the church, I think it's high, much higher, like 70 to 80, but still. So it's a common thing, and there's no or the cultural guardrails of shame, difficulty of access,
Yeah, virtue, modesty. I
right?
mean, all of the
They're all
cardinal
gone.
virtues. I mean,
They're
these,
conceding.
temperance. Yeah, I mean, we could easily be described at this moment as like grumpy old men, decrying the excesses of youth or whatever. But, having, as I know you also having ministered to and among the carnage that this has produced in people's lives, whether they're married or single or hope to be married, is staggering and heartbreaking. And it's easy to say, well, I'm glad it was not as accessible when I was, a younger man and not really a Christian, and certainly in the same way that I am now by God's grace. It's easy to say that, but there's a real truth to that also. I mean, like you said, I mean, I would have to, I mean, there was like a, you have to go, as Aaron points out, often to the mafia to do most of this stuff. Like a sports book could be caught and arrested, like a drug dealer was on the corner of neighborhoods you didn't want to go to unless you were looking for that. And of course, prostitution, was the oldest profession, but certainly not valorized, except in notable places that respectable gentlemen didn't go, and now it's been mainstreamed. And of course, in all excesses of sin, the people who are the most vulnerable are the ones who are the ones who are the preyed upon. And so you see, the age of consent in various countries being argued down. You see prohibitions against pedophilia, or what they call the groomers, rising. You see, like you said, Matt, this sort of libertarian, anarchic libertarian argument that that human freedom means freedom from any. Well, who was it? Isaiah Berlin, I think. The distinction between freedom from and freedom to. I think I'm not fact checking myself at the moment, but at any rate, the concept is apt that freedom is not, at least in a Christian perspective, just a freedom from prohibition, but it's a freedom to service and love and self-mastery, or at least the fruits of the spirit. That's the freedom you give, against which there is no law, Paul says. Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness, faithfulness, and self-control. And we were talking about this today in our Romans Bible study. We were making at least the argument, I don't know if it's explicit, but nevertheless it holds, that if you take Romans 1 through 12 is kind of the buildup of the argument, and then the great therefore, in view of God's mercies, Romans 12, then you have the diagnosis in the beginning and the peak of idolatry and buying into the lie, worshiping the creature rather than the creator, is ultimately seen in sexual depravity, because it begins from the human heart and works its way out. And then it works its way out, not just in your own sphere, but into destruction of neighbor, destruction of self and destruction of neighbor. So the converse of that would be love of God, love of self rightly, and love of neighbor. So then Romans 12, you have the counterpoint. In view of God's mercy, present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable. This is your spiritual worship. So the sort of juxtaposition of wanton fleshly spirituality versus redeemed, justified Christian spirituality is, in fact, begins, in the bedroom, as Robert Jensen would say. I mean, that was a shocking thing to read in his systematic, I mean, God rest his soul, when I ran across at least his discussion of the argument that, keep your laws out of my bedroom. And his argument in general was, well, if there are something like just laws, then, and if they don't apply in your bedroom, then they can't naturally apply anywhere else. And I didn't really understand that at the time, but now it's beginning to make more sense, because we have laws against all sorts of things, from suicide to different, depraved sexualities to gambling, cheating, lying, and stealing. And these are things that begin. I mean, I think the bedroom's a metaphor for your, in your own heart. And our government, in the West, at least, has abdicated its God-given authority to help people protect themselves against themselves. Because, of course, because of sin, we're never going to fully be eradicated of our carnal nature, or at least the propensity towards that. That's concupiscence. And I, for one, with my five little boys and my girls, for that matter, would love some extra guardrails and some helpful protection from the in loco parentis idea of their educators and then their government. And instead, they increasingly are seen, at least according to the Michigan Lottery, as like in the Matrix, like this giant machine just want to bleed them dry from the inside out, via all of these vices. And it has to stop. I mean, I could get really fired up about it. I mean, I've been advocating that people in my congregation should run for town council, and we should be the first city who gets one of those, porn nets or whatever, which should be so simple to do. I mean, if you can, there's all sorts of passwords and things that you have to fill out for all sorts of, everything else. Like, I mean, I have Starlink, which is, I hope if Elon must be one of our listeners, but I have, Starlink has a bunch of little things you can click that will filter out all sorts of, material before it even gets to your computer. And I'm like, add about 100 more of those if you don't mind. 'Cause, I give my, we try to keep our kids off screens, but, there's just some things like Duolingo, for instance, and the Canon Plus app that we love. And so, but I'm heartened that at the very least, they're not going to type in, just some word and then accidentally hit image and all of a sudden you lose innocence over like in a second, and I'm grateful for that. But it's got to, there's something that's going to change. And it looks like the next generation of people is pushing back at the very least, the younger generation on the excesses of this quote unquote freedom, because you do see, like, I run into young men all the time who don't even have smartphones because they either have gone through the cycle and realized its destructive nature, or they are aware of how pernicious it could be and just refuse. And I say, well, if that's what you have to do, then praise God. But it's, there should be more of a consensus than that than there is. And so here we are.
What's interesting to me is that, before Christianity became the prominent Western religion and philosophical perspective, pagan Greece and pagan Rome understood the concept that if you let your passions run wild, you're gonna be a slave. You're gonna be enslaved to them. The hedonism wasn't the governing principle. In the first century, when Paul is goes to Athens, the two primary competing philosophies are Stoicism and Epicureanism. And
That's
both
right.
involve a level of self, well, Stoicism especially, it involves a level of self-control, not to be a slave to anything.
That's right.
Epicureanism isn't rank hedonism. It's you enjoy every pleasure with the least amount of pain, and you kind of get to, I mean, that also involves a level of self-control in order to have a happy life. So pagans understood this. But
Yeah, I mean, Plato wanted to get rid of all the poets, because these people that were inspired and enthusiastic and so, could not be good rulers, But no, you're exactly right. And I mean, to be fair, they had much different moral, they had a different morality within which they were seeking the good life. Sarah Rudin was helpful for that in us. But no, exactly to your point, Matt, is that this sort of debased, wanton giving yourself over to every carnal desire, it was seen animalistic. It was like Augustine saying, what raise yourself up above the base animalistic urges of your human of your created nature and be a human. I mean, I'm paraphrasing there, but and it's heartbreaking. And I mean, obviously, you can feel, I mean, we as sinful humans are aware of the allure, she looked at the fruit and saw that it was pleasurable and to the eyes and the temptation, the allure of sin. But the consequences of it are really lost on the young outside of a loving educational framework, of parents who are given to teach and admonish and to reprove and all the things. And so we see what happens. You have you have parent. I actually think part of it is that the generation who was gave themselves over to these vices, and then it's like it's like the old, when we were growing up, they had this big discussion about, even if you smoked weed at what Woodstock, like you can still tell your kids not to do it. That was like a big moral, and I think there's a lot of that. That is part of this, is that you have people who have engaged in these vices wholeheartedly, and now they have children, and there's a real sort of moral sort of conundrum as to, was it wrong? Because if it's wrong for my kids, then it was wrong for me, and I shouldn't have done it. But without the framework of repentance and absolution and forgiveness and mercy, then you have to double down. You have to, and that's what we're watching time and time again.
Matt, I'm curious to know, and I'm not a historian here. You're much more the historian than I am, but I'm curious to know how well that pagan philosophy of the Greeks, for instance, filtered down to like the common person and society in general. Because as Chidi alluded to, there's still a pretty well depraved society overall. It seems to be unique to Christianity that the individual Johnny Q. Public, if you will, has a desire to better oneself, if that's a phrase I can use. We talk about it in terms of sanctification and becoming likened to Christ. That seems a uniquely Christian thing where an individual might say, I'm going to, not because, you know, Socrates thinks it might be the theoretical way to live your life, but I'm actually called by my creator to conform myself into what he wants for me.
I mean, I do think that Christianity completely changed the way, as it took hold, completely changed the way people thought of their lives, obviously, because it's the true truth. But that being said, I mean, think about what, you know, when Paul's writing to the Corinthian church, he says, like, when I came to you, I made a decision not to know anything except Jesus Christ and him crucified. And his point there is, I'm not going to use the rhetoric of the philosophers. I'm going to just speak plainly about the cross. And that's going to demonstrate the power of the cross. But the reason he said that is because it, from my understanding, and maybe JD knows more here too, but from my understanding, it wasn't
likely. It's likely.
It wasn't uncommon for the common people to want to listen to, you know, philosophers passing through. And this is in Corinth, where, you know, to Corinthianize became like a way of talking about being really licentious. But there were popular level, as I understand it, popular level philosophers who had come through and teach, quote unquote, the good life. Here, you follow my program and this will help you live a better life. And it was lots of people loved to listen to these guys. They had a rhetorical style that was compelling. And so the expectation on the part of the Corinthians was that Paul should become like one of them. And Paul's saying, no, I'm not going to become like one of them.
Right.
I'm going to preach the gospel. And so I think with that evidence, I think we can say, you know, there was at least in Corinth, and I would say probably in most Greek cities, a sense even in the lower echelons of the class, that, yeah, we philosophy is a good thing. Maybe not platonic, but popular level philosophy, like maybe the equivalent of a self-help book in our day. Want to watch Dr. Phil or watch Oprah or whatever and try and figure out how to make some changes to your life, that kind of thing, I think would have been
nothing's really changed in that respect, right? Fraternity tests
like,
and things.
That actually seems like a perfect example of what I was fumbling my way through trying to say, which is that I think, like somebody who watches Oprah and who thinks thereby they're going to improve their life, but then goes out and continues to live the same life they lived the day before and will live the day after, they sort of present as though they're looking for help, but really they're just feeding their own appetites. That's one of their appetites, in fact.
Reason.
Yeah, I mean, no, you're exactly right. And, you know, I think in all of this discussion, though, you know, with respect to the similarities in human nature and our desire to sort of, you know, hopefully be ordered in some, you know, eudaimonistic way, the sea change of sexual morality in particular that Christianity brought into that Greco-Roman context cannot be understated. I mean, the profundity of it. And I'm just reminded, you know, we had Sarah Rudin come, who wrote a book to St. Francis. Remember, Nick, you were there.
Yeah.
And she wrote a book called Paul Among the People, the Apostle Reinterpreted. And the central thesis of the book is that everyone that's complaining about Paul being sort of, you know, this misogynistic, homophobic, backwards thinking kind of troglodyte, have no idea what was actually taking place in the world to which he was preaching. And she just goes through the various kind of revolutionary ideas, beginning with men and women and monogamy and child. You know, there's that book. There's another book called When Children Became People, you know, for instance, which is a horrifying book, only in the way it describes the fact that, you know, basically largely because of Christian teaching, children became something that weren't just, they only had human dignity if they were desired. I mean, can you imagine that? I mean, you know, what, nothing new under the sun, right? But that there was this revolutionary change that began by God's mercies to address the very cancerous centers of our souls that when addressed and begin to be healed and restored and redeemed would actually emanate outwards from the newly redeemed person and begin to affect positive change in their world. You know, I mean, husbands reconciled to wives, then reconciled to children, and then they would have neighbors reconciled to each other. They become little clans and towns and villages and nations in the world. I mean, that's how it works. And I don't think I think it's clearly demonic, in part because, like C.S. Lewis says in that part of Screwtape Letters, you know, the demons feast on the souls of the damned, whereas that our enemy in heaven loves these creatures, you know. But it's not surprising to me that the wave of vice that promises life actually is like the fentanyl for the soul. Like it's incredibly addictive, it's destructive, and left untreated or undiagnosed, it will destroy you. Like it's just flatly, you know. I mean, and the number of people whose marriages, whose lives, whose children, whose relationships with their family and friends that have been destroyed by gambling and drugs and pornography or just adultery or whatever, pernicious and wanton sexual deviancy. I mean, that's the history of the world, but for the intervention of God and Christ for the sake of people's souls. And so, you know, I think not only is it demonic, I think that it again, back to the government, and I've been very persuaded by this. I forget where I heard it first, but I've been thinking about it for years now. With the rise of Leviathan, you know, as Hobbes would say, of the sort of tyrannical state, the best person for a state to control is pliable and essentially weak. And nothing is weaker than you know, what the Bible describes a city without walls. You know, man without self-control is like a city without walls. You tear down
Drug
these
addicted,
walls.
porn addled.
That's right. You
What's
know,
the third
and
one? Oh yeah,
pseudo men.
drug addicted, porn addled gambler. That's
That's right. That's
the
right. Pseudo men who, you know, then on the flip side get the dopamine high for pretending to be athletes, pretending to be savvy businessmen because they scratched off three of the right five little footballs on their credit bought lottery ticket. And then of course they feel like they're sort of, you know, sort of virile sexual, have had the sexual conquest because they've been sitting in their basement watching porn forever. And it's, you know, who was it wrote Demise of Guys? Was it Bum John? I forget his name. But anyway, there's a book. You can Google it, The Demise of Guys. And this was like 20 years ago. It's the same guy that did the Stanford Prison Experiment. Anyway, he says that those three aspects, porn, video games, and gambling, have harnessed the sort of innate drives of men towards productivity and turn them against themselves and is now the means of their own destruction. Where's the party that's running on the abolition of porn, the outlawing of gambling, and the, you know, the re-legal, making drugs illegal again? You know, it's like that seems, you know, the anti-mafia party. Like, let's go ahead, Matt. I'm going to nominate you from the floor to be the next president of the anti-mafia party. Because what's next? You know, now we're going to destigmatize putting people in cinder block shoes and throwing them off bridges, you know, or whatever. That's the next step. It's like Goodfellas was sourced to be a cautionary tale, not a instructional video that you watch, you know, when you get citizenship. But here we are. And to your point, it's like the shame is one thing, but you know, shame is still downstream from pain and actual destruction, you know, and that's really what drives me in this, is that I'm looking at these little boys, and I have young boys, and I have a 9-year-old, and we've talked about this inappropriate, you know, even now, you know, if you see something or if you're getting scared or whatever, you know. But I'm looking at, you know, my other four are four and under, and the innocence and the joy, and of course they're going to lose some of this because of their sinners, but the idea of throwing them into not just a hostile world, but just simply full of wolves. Like, these aren't even wolves in sheep clothing. These are just a bunch of wolves. Well, I'd like to do something about that, you know, or I'm going to. I mean, to the extent I can. But you know, it begins in the church, you know. And I think that, you know, some of those stats you talked about, Matt, need to be addressed. And it's not just porn, you know. I mean, I think the gambling kind of lax attitudes towards modesty, towards decorum, towards chastity, prudence. I mean, these things that were dismissed as Victorian
Yeah, we
moralism.
used to name our children after these virtues.
That's right. That's right. So, you know, and again, I know I sound, I mean, to my 25-year-old self, I sound like an old grumpy moralist, but I had no responsibilities to, so to speak, when I was 25, except to myself. And I felt like I was doing a pretty good job. Now I have considerable more responsibilities, and not just in my own family, but by extension, the church. And I feel for them, and I want to defend them, and I want to encourage and equip them. And having the government, in particular, not on our side, as it were, is something novel in the history of Western Christendom, at the very least. And so here we
Yeah.
are.
I mean, a young man who has absolutely no outlet for his sexual drive except for marriage is going to be a young man who does everything he can to get married.
Amen.
He's going to adjust all of his life so he's productive, he's successful,
That's right.
he's taking baths,
Gonna sign up to all of those free dance lessons
right.
classes that they have. Like, I know the jitterbug, I know the shag, I know the box step, I know all of them now. Because I'm here for
You
it.
harness like incredible power. That's incredible cultural power.
Amen.
You have men who that's their outlet is finding a woman who will consent to marry them. And then you have women who also want that, who want men who are and won't give themselves to men who are dissolute.
That's right.
Then you have the building blocks of a culture. But without that, you have what we have now, which is, I know young men who should be striving hard to find women, but I for a while I couldn't figure out why is this guy, so kind of placid about everything. And I realized, I can't say for sure about everyone I know who's like this, but pornography. I mean,
It's Ted.
why
And a vape pen every now and then. A vape pen would
Why
probably
he
help
doesn't
too.
if he doesn't feel like he's got to impress anybody because he's got all the sex he wants, click at a click of a button, then why should he bother with the girls out there who might reject him?
Well, there's a famous book by a guy named J.D. Unwin. It's like 7,000 pages. I mean, it's enormous. But he talks about the sort of civilizational collapse that comes with a abdication of anything like sexual morality. And it's the most harrowing part of the book is that we're in the, he says it takes three generations and we're in the middle of the third. And so that's very, like, Lord have mercy. Because Matt, what you're describing is what's called they call it the unity of the goods, you know? And so all of the creative and powerful drives that God has stamped, particularly men with, it's not just men, but there's a, to defend, to protect, to create, to build all these things when not directed in the right, well, direction, become, like I said before, the means of our own destruction. And so, when you have, and I can speak to this, I've used this analogy before, but Laz and I, as you all know, we're wrestling to have children. It was part of our story, and but nevertheless, we didn't have them. And the sort of the sense and weight of responsibility that landed on me, roughly 10 to 11 years ago, when I simultaneously, in the 3 month period, became a rector of a church and a father, has been nothing short of a process of rebuilding, like an entire rebuilding of my life. And I trust in the Lord's providence that that was part of now the story that I get to tell and part of the witness that we have. But in the normative pattern of marriage, we would have already had a, 2-year-old, a year or two into our marriage. And I trust that the same weight would have hit then, or at least I expected it would have. And so, that's just where I am. But I can speak now. I've processed this, I think, in the Lord's providence. The witness that I now have is almost like a second conversion, almost. I mean, it was like, okay, oh, wait, that's what it means to actually have responsibility and purpose and direction and drive. Because, of course, Liza, she was of an adult when we got married, and so she, to the extent that she could know, knew what she was getting into. But this little baby girl that I was holding, she was given to me. And I think that all of that, as part of the normative Christian ecosystem that is being lost for all the reasons we talk about all the time, is contributing to the rise in really. It's really a suicide, really, is what it is. Like, it's a moral suicide, like a nihilistic giving over to immediate pleasure and gratification, which, you have to think, to the most addicted of these sad souls, there's still moments of clarity where they say, maybe I shouldn't have done this. Maybe I shouldn't have, gambled away my month's rent. Maybe I should have gone out instead of sat and watched 16 hours of hardcore pornography. But then, we're slaves to this. I mean, we're, who sins is a slave to sin. And without the intervention of the cross and the breaking of that cycle, then it's just a spiral down.
We should state clearly that you're not exaggerating. This is a societal suicide. If Christianity can be credited with the rise and ascendancy of the West, which I think it can be, then the removal of Christianity will lead to the destruction and fall of the West. So it's
That's
nothing
right.
less than a suicide.
That's right. Well, who was it? Os Guinness, the hero of Free People's Suicide. He wrote that book. I mean, this is the thesis, is that, you have this freedom and you're using it to destroy civilization, from one soul out to another. So we got our work cut out for us, obviously. I'm grateful that we have something to say. The diagnosis from Romans 1 couldn't get more clear every day. And yet there's more chapters in that book than just the first one. And, we see the great therefore, as I said before, in Romans 12, that reorders the entire human person around self-sacrifice as the spiritual worship, and then the renewing of your mind of what is good and perfect and true. And that pretty much sums up the work of the church and the gift of God in his condescension through his word to the world. And that's going to get resisted, and that will be mocked and pilloried by unbelief and sin. But as Luther told Erasmus, that is not our problem. It's like our call is to preach and to watch the Holy Spirit save, redeem, and release people from this bondage to self and to sin. And it's an indwelling sickness unto death, as it were, that will be persistent in us, but we have been given the means of grace and the hope of glory to fight, and particularly to a message to young men. It is a battle. They're not just pornography, but all of these things are a battle. And to hearken to the valorous, echoes of Eden that perhaps are still dormant within even the most porn-addled soul, that you can withstand, you can stand up, and you can regain something of your humanity above the animals. And that seems to be a message. Well, it's the gospel, but it also, in very practical terms, a sort of natural law argument that is beginning to make even the most hardened atheists reconsider perhaps the unalloyed good of wanton human freedom. And for that, I'm very grateful, and heartened to see, particularly among young men and women for that matter, a beginning stages of a resistance and a rejection of these excesses. And it's incredibly encouraging, and only hope that it's signs of God not fully removing his hand of mercy from us, and perhaps even bestowing upon us something like a revival of Christian virtue, morality, and goodness for the sake of the world.
Well, we are out of time for this week. Thank you, as always, for listening to Stand Firm. If you want to keep the conversation going with us, you can be in touch, rate and review the podcast on iTunes, send us an email at mailbag@standfirminfaith.com, or join the Anglicans for the Gospel Facebook group. Thanks to JD Koch and Matt Kennedy. I'm Nick Lannon, and Lord willing, we'll be back next week. Until then, by the grace of God and Jesus Christ, we'll be standing firm.